So let's continue on in the text where we left off. So we're in the second of the 7 points. The second of the 7 points is training in the two minds of awakening, the main practice. So the main practice here, of course, is the two bodhicittas, the conventional bodhicitta and the ultimate bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta, of course, is this wisdom realizing emptiness. And we're first looking at the ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom realizing emptiness, the Vipassana practice. And we're looking at the actual meditation session, how we are to meditate here in the Vipassana practice to come to realize this emptiness. And we saw in the meditation practice we need to prepare ourselves well. And then there was a discussion here about allowing shamatha to give birth to the shoots of realization, meaning that if we want our Vipassana practice to go well, then we need to put some effort into the shamatha practice. We need to really work on cultivating a very calm, clear and focused mind. Because without that, we can put a lot of effort into Vipassana practice and not really get very far, because our mind is constantly distracted or dull in our practice. So we talked a little bit about the shamatha practice, so we've finished that now. So we'll go back into the text. So we're on page 3 of the commentary on the right-hand column near the top, where it says, next, the initial meditation on the absence of intrinsic existence of perceived objects is presented in the following line. And the slogan here is, train to view all phenomena as dreamlike. Now, to backtrack a little bit, we said that from the various teachings of the Buddha, we have four philosophical schools emerging in ancient India. We have the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika schools emerging from the first turning of the wheel, the Four Noble Truths teachings. We have the Majjhimika philosophical system evolving from the second turning of the wheel, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And the third turning of the wheel, we have the Chittamatra, mind-only philosophical system emerging. So what do each one of those say about phenomena? What do they say, do a phenomena dreamlike? And the first two schools coming out of the Four Noble Truths, Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, of course, do not accept that phenomena are dreamlike. Because for them, phenomena exist as they appear. For them, there is an independent external world there. So they both accept that the way in which we see phenomena is not deceptive. Phenomena exist. They are made up of atomic particles, collections of those, and that exists there independent of us as it appears to us. So for them, phenomena are not dreamlike. Because dreamlike here means a dream is something that does not exist as it appears to us. Because in a dream, the dream world appears to be real, physical world. But if we become lucid in the dream, we'll realize that this dream world is deceiving us. So therefore, here, what we're saying in this text is to view all phenomena as dreamlike, meaning to view things as not existing as they appear. So Vaibhashika and Sautrantika would not agree with this statement. They'd say that phenomena are not dreamlike because they're actually existing in the way they appear. So remember, for Vaibhashika, Sautrantika then, the problem is only how we see ourselves as a person. We overinflate the sense of me, we grasp onto self. This is the fundamental ignorance we need to overcome to achieve nirvana. When we come to the Chittamatra philosophical system, they would agree with this statement that all phenomena are dreamlike. Because for them, there appears to be an independent external world there, but if we investigate closely, we'll come to realize there's no external world there whatsoever, that the world is internal to our mind. So they say that phenomena are independent internal world. So for them, emptiness means the world is empty of being external. There's no external world. It's internal to the mind. Majjhamika, of course, this text is on the basis of Majjhamika system, so of course Majjhamika would agree with the fact that all phenomena are dreamlike. And they would say, and that's what we're going to look at now, is that if we really investigate, we'll come to see that there is no independent world there. That there is no independent me, no independent world. So they would say that the world is a dependent external world. What that really means is what we're going to look at here in the text. So I thought I'd just briefly mention that so we get an idea of what the other schools are saying about this. All phenomena are dreamlike. Any questions about that before we look at this, what that really means? Okay, let's go straight in then. And to begin our discussion here of the commentary, I'd like to again read from Alan Wallace. This time it's a book he wrote some years ago called Tibetan Buddhism from the Ground Up. And here he's talking about this idea, well, is there really an independent external world there or not?
Which page in the book?
179. He says, many of us believe that we directly perceive objective physical phenomena with our five physical senses. That the images we perceive via our senses are accurate representations of the objects we perceive. However, neurologist Antonio Damasio refutes this assumption, which is commonly called naive realism. So now he's quoting the neurologist who says the following. When you and I look at an object outside ourselves, we form comparable images in our respective brains. We know this well because you and I can describe the object in very similar ways, down to fine details. But that does not mean that the image we see is the copy of whatever the object outside is like. Whatever it is like, in absolute terms, we do not know. Now back to Alan Wallace. He says the following. In light of this neuroscientific view, with our five senses, we directly perceive images generated in the brain. But these are not truly representations of anything existing independently of the brain. These sensory impressions of colours, sounds, smells, and so on are no more tangible than thoughts or dreams. While we seem to experience colours and so on as they exist in the objective world, independent of our senses, this is an illusion, very much like a dream. Having determined that the reality we perceive depends on our sense faculties, What then really does exist outside our senses? When we close this book and leave the room, shutting the door behind us, what remains? It is an ancient question that has been asked since the time of the Greeks. What exists behind appearances? What really exists out there? This brings up a familiar problem. What happens when a tree falls and nobody is in the forest to watch it or hear it? Most people agree something happened. The tree trunk is on the ground, there is a big dent, things start to rot, and ants and termites live in the fallen trunk. But what happened? Western scientists have traditionally responded to this question by trying to find primary or intrinsic qualities of the falling tree that can be measured. Mass is one of those, the idea being that the tree has a quantifiable amount of stuff to it. Speed is another quality that does not seem to depend on anyone's perception. Briefly considering the history of Western scientific thinking on this point may be a useful digression that may help us better understand the nature of emptiness. Also, by examining our cultural assumptions about the nature of reality, we can better understand and penetrate those assumptions, and by so doing, come to appreciate the Buddhist view. Since Galileo took his telescope and turned it on Jupiter, scientific thought has increasingly depended on the power of mechanical instruments. We get the sense, and it is widely promoted by science, that by using mechanical instruments and mathematics, we stop being subjective and instead become objective. Everyone knows the senses can be misleading, it is said, so let us dispense with the senses. They are only giving us appearances anyway, and we're trying to penetrate through those. The idea of objective measurement came to be strongly emphasized during the time of Galileo, and by the end of the 19th century, scientists felt the objective science of physics was virtually complete. The physics of the time was assumed, with very few exceptions, to be an absolute representation of what was really out there. At the beginning of the 20th century, this view began to break down. Scientists started to understand more clearly that their instruments of measurement were themselves contributing to the data they were detecting. But the real revolution came with the development of quantum physics, which investigates the very smallest components of physical reality. It is here that the participatory nature of measurement and experimentation becomes most obvious. In quantum mechanics, attributes of mass, speed, shape, and location vanish as purely objective entities. All of them can only be seen in relationship to the methods of measurement. As the renowned physicist Werner Heisenberg said, "What we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning." As scientists looked still deeper, they also started questioning the objectivity of the analytical tools they use. Mathematics, for instance, is one more human creation. Euclidean geometry is only one of a theoretically infinite number of geometries that can be used, and the same goes for algebra and for various logic systems. The subjective element seems to be inescapable on all fronts. In no facet of science, whether we are dealing with astronomy, physics, or medicine, do we even get one bit of information about any reality existing independently of our modes of questioning. All our sensory experience consists of experiences that are contingent upon our sense faculties. Even by reducing everything to the subatomic level of electrons, quarks, and so forth, we are still left with nothing but appearances. What is inescapable is that all that we know of the world, theoretically and empirically, consists of appearances to the mind. We have access to nothing else. Understanding this, the concept of reification becomes universally applicable. In the same way that we look out on the world and view perceived objects as if they existed inherently in objective space, so too do we view things like electrons and sound waves as if they existed independently of our conceptions of them. Perceived objects exist in relation to the conceptual schemata within which they are understood. We reify an object by removing it from its context, by ignoring the subjective influences of perception and conception. So let's have a look now at what this statement here that says train to view all phenomena as dreamlike. What does that mean? So the commentary here says, this entire world of the external environment and the beings within it, which are by nature mere appearances, are nothing but apparitions of your own deluded mind. Thus, not even a single atom exists with a reality separate from the mind. When you examine thus, you will come to realize that even on the conventional level, no referent of your awareness is established as possessing substantially true existence. Contemplate in this manner. So, what we're saying here is that how do things appear to us is that they appear as if they existed independently of us. And here in the text, you find a couple of terms that are used when we're talking about this word independent existence. Probably one of the most common words or terms you'll hear is inherent existence. And here, that's the original term is translated slightly different as, I think, intrinsic existence. Yes, we see the intrinsic existence. It's the same word in Tibetan and Sanskrit, inherent or intrinsic existence. And this word here, inherent existence, has the idea that things are self-existent. They exist within themselves. That the world is made up of many separate, discrete things, each one having its own unique nature of being that thing, being self-existent. Another term that you'll commonly see is things existing from their own side. And this has the idea or meaning that of things existing without depending on an observer. They simply exist from their own side, meaning the world is already existing out there, just waiting for us to experience that world that already exists there from its own side. So existing from its own side means existing without the need of an observer. And another term that we often see, true existence, which also is mentioned here, the word true really generally means something is true if it doesn't deceive us. Now here, things appear to exist independent of us. If that's actually how they exist, they would be true. Meaning the way in which they appear and the way in which they actually exist match. So true existence means existing in the same way in which it appears. So these three terms are talking about independent existence from a slightly different perspective. So they all mean the same thing. So these are some terms that you commonly see in the texts.
You can repeat the third one. I didn't understand.
True existence.
Yes.
Something is true in general if it doesn't deceive us. Okay. If it's not deceptive. Things appear to exist independent of us. If that's actually how they exist, they would be true, meaning they're not deceiving us. It's not like they appear to exist in one way, but they actually exist in another way. That's not true. That's false. So true existence means existing in the same way in which they appear. Any other questions? So here, it says that if we examine, you'll come to realize that even in a conventional level, no referent of your awareness is established as possessing substantially true existence. Means, if we examine this world, we'll come to see that there is no referent, meaning there is no object there that has true existence, meaning there is nothing that exists independently. And if we go back to the first part of the first sentence, it says the entire world of the external environment beings within it, which are by nature mere appearances. Mere appearances. So we're saying that things are not existing independently of us. They are mere appearances. So the reasoning that we have here is, is that things are empty of inherent existence. So here this term, empty of inherent existence, is the same as saying things are not independently existent because they are dependently existent. And here the term for that is dependent arisings. So this phrase here, empty of inherent existence, is emptiness. So again, when we say things are empty of inherent existence, we're saying things are not inherently existent, or in other words, things are not independently existent. Why? Because they are dependently existent. Here the word arising means coming into existence. Things come into existence dependently. So therefore, if we can appreciate how things are dependent arisings, in other words, what it means for something to exist dependently, if we can really appreciate that, then we'll have a better understanding of emptiness, because emptiness is saying that things are not independently existent. And that's going to lead us to this statement that things are mere appearances, because that's part of what it means to be dependent. So let's have a look now at what does it mean for things to be dependent arisings, that things exist dependently. The first way in which things exist dependently or are dependent arisings is that things exist depending on causes and conditions. For example, this laptop here exists depending on causes and conditions. One of the very first conditions necessary was that someone needed to think about designing this laptop. And then, of course, all the raw materials needed to be gathered. They needed to be refined. All the various components needed to be manufactured. And then all those components needed to be assembled. And then, of course, all the people and factories and so forth involved in the process also necessary. So all of those causes and conditions are necessary for us to have the laptop here today. It's fairly straightforward. I think we more or less understand that. But also, things exist depending on their parts. This laptop exists depending on its parts. Without the metal casing, the screen, the keyboard, electronic components, the battery, without all of these parts, there would be no laptop. So again, that's fairly straightforward, that everything exists depending on its parts. But what we're saying here is that these ideas that things are dependent should be overturning our idea that things are independent. I mean, that's the logic here. But I think most of us will probably be fairly happy to accept that this laptop exists depending on causes and conditions, exists depending on its parts, yet at the same time, we're probably happy to accept that when we walk in the door, there's already a laptop existing on the table here. True? That shouldn't be possible, according to this logic. Those two ideas are contradictory. So why is it that we can happily accept this and the fact that there's already a laptop existing on the table when we walk in the door? The reason is we don't really understand these at the deepest level. We only understand these two ideas fairly superficially. To really understand these at a deeper level, we have to go to the third way in which things are dependent. And here we have a number of different words that are used. That things exist depending on imputation, labelling, conception, designation. All of these four words mean the same thing. And when we look at these words, we think, I know what that means. There's a thing on the table here which we're calling a laptop. Again, this is a fairly superficial understanding. To understand this at a deeper level, what we can understand is that when we look out on the world, what we receive is a mass of sense data, particularly visual data. And we have to make some sense or meaning out of all of this data. Otherwise, we couldn't function. So what we do is we actually draw lines around various collections of data and we create objects to make meaning out of all of this. And not only do we draw lines and create objects, we have to give them names because we have to communicate with others. So this third point is the process of drawing lines and then giving the name. And how we draw the lines is not fixed. It's completely arbitrary, depending on the meaning that we want to get out of what we experience. For example, how many objects are there? How many things are there? How many objects?
One or nine or two.
I mean, probably most commonly, what would be meaningful for us in most contexts would be we draw one line and go, there's a star. But in another situation, it may be more useful to draw two lines and say there's two triangles. In another situation, we may draw six lines and say there's six triangles. Or seven lines, meaning six triangles and a hexagon. Or in other cases, it may be useful just to say there's a collection of 18 lines there. So is there 1, 2, 6, 7, or 18 things there? How many things are there?
Depends on who is looking at it.
We decide how many things are there. So there is no star there existing from its own side. We create the star by drawing a line and then giving the name. So therefore, we say that things are merely labelled. Merely means just or only, meaning there is no star to be found there. So another term you'll hear here in this situation is that things are not findable. Meaning you cannot find a star here in the basis. There is no star existing there from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework. A star only exists within our conceptual framework. There is no star to be found there, independent of our conceptual framework. Hence, things are merely labelled. Or in this case, in the text, it says things are mere appearances. And mere appearances is another way of saying this. The star is a mere appearance. It's not existing there from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework. And so that's what's saying here. It says, when you examine thus, you will come to realize that even on a conventional level, no referent of your awareness is established as possessing substantially true existence. Meaning that there is no referent, meaning there is no star there to be found in the basis. You will not find a star there existing independently of our conceptual framework. Only exists in our conceptual framework. It's a mere appearance. It's merely labelled. Not findable in the basis. Any questions about that? Okay. Let's now go back to these two ideas based on this understanding. So this is a timeline, this is a seed, and this is the plant that it produces. And we say that the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. The underlying cause of the plant, of course, is a seed. The conditions are all the soil, sunlight, water, and so forth, all the other things necessary for this transformation to take place. Now, we believe that things exist independently, independent of our conceptual framework, which means it must be a fixed, obvious point where the seed becomes the plant. So at what point in this process does the seed become the plant? At what point does the seed become the plant? Who can tell me? Where does the seed become the plant in the process?
The point that you choose to call it.
Exactly. The point at where the seed becomes a plant, we determine that. Because the point is at where this configuration of data stops looking like our concept of seed and starts looking like our concept of plant. That's the point where the seed becomes the plant. And each one of us have slightly different idea about what is a seed and what is a plant. So for some of us, the point may already be here, some of us here, some of us here. We determine when the seed becomes the plant. Another point. The seed and the plant are in a cause and effect relationship. And by definition, if two things are in a cause and effect relationship, they cannot exist simultaneously, by definition. Now the question is, does the seed cease existing before the plant comes into existence? So think about it. Does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? There can only be two answers, yes or no. Which is it? Does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So the seed has ceased to exist. Where is the plant coming from? The seed has already ceased to exist. So where's the plant coming from? If you say no...
It's a gradual thing. But there is a point where there's no seed anymore.
And if you say no... That implies they exist at the same time, which by definition is impossible. If two things are in a cause and effect relationship, they cannot exist simultaneously. So no is illogical. And if you say yes, yes is illogical because the seed has ceased to exist. Where's the plant coming from? So what we can see is that based on our belief that things exist independently, common sense ideas like cause and a result don't work anymore. It's impossible. They can't work. So what we can appreciate from that is that things do not exist independently. And Nagarjuna, who's the founder of this Majjhimika philosophical system we're following, in the 2nd century, he wrote a classic text called Mula Majjhimika Karika, Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way. And in that, he has 27 chapters of these sorts of arguments. He says, you believe in independent existence? What about seed and plant? How does that work? How does agent and action work? Fire and fuel? How does that work? And then we look at that and we go, oh, actually it becomes completely illogical. It can't work based on our assumption that things exist independently. So through doing these logical arguments, we can break down our belief or the false belief that things exist independently. Of course, things exist independently, then we don't have that problem. We're simply changing the label. And actually, it's this point where our idea of impermanence is very helpful. Maybe I've mentioned already that not only if we, you know, in the Theravada, the very first insight in Vipassana practice we're trying to gain is an insight into impermanence. Things are changing moment by moment. And if we can bring that inside and realize it, already your attachment to pleasant things, your aversion to unpleasant things will dramatically decrease. But another thing that was going to happen in that realization is that that realization is very close to realizing emptiness. If we really realize impermanence, we're very close to realizing emptiness. Because if we really realize impermanence, we're going to understand what we mean by subtle impermanence. Now, of course, often when subtle impermanence is explained, it's explained as something like things are changing moment by moment. And then we go, okay, I know what that means. That means in this moment we have a thing that changes into something else in the next moment. And then the next moment that thing changes into something else. Is this subtle impermanence? No. Impossible. In fact, if this is our idea, we end up with the same logical absurdity as here. So subtle impermanence is not this, it's this. And if we realize impermanence, we're going to realize Subtle impermanence is not there's a thing in this moment that in the next moment becomes something else, becomes something else, becomes something else. That's impossible. It's impossible. Because we can use the same logical reasoning as this to show that this can't work. It's illogical. Because if this becomes this, and this has ceased, where is this coming from? It doesn't work. So therefore, we can, by realizing impermanence, we're very close to realizing emptiness. Very close. Another point. We say that the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. In other words, we're saying that the plant or the result depends on the cause. Straightforward. But this view here is also saying that the cause depends on the result. How does the cause depend on the result? How does the cause depend on the result?
A seed is a seed because it contains a plant. If it wouldn't bring forth the plant, we wouldn't call it a seed.
Exactly. You can't call this a seed unless you have the idea that it could produce a plant. Whether or not it does is irrelevant. But you can't call something a cause unless you have the idea that it could potentially produce a result. So having cause without the idea result is illogical. Okay, now let's look at paths. This pen exists depending on its paths. But can we find a pen here in the bases? Is there a pen to be found here? Is this a pen? No. Is this a pen? No. Is the metal tube a pen? No. Is this piece of plastic a pen? No. Is the ink inside a pen? No. Is the round ball on the end a pen? No. Where's the pen? People go, oh, easy. It's the collection. The pen is the collection of the parts. There's the collection. Oh, no. In a certain shape. So you have to tell me when the pen comes into existence.
When the mind calls it a pen.
Then you can use it as a pen.
You can use only the...
So from this exercise, we can understand we bring the pen into existence when this collection of data closely enough resembles our concept of pen. And our concepts usually have at least two parts, appearance and functionality. So when this appears closely enough to our idea of pen, and it seems to function according to our idea of pen, then there's a pen, not before. If the pen exists from its own side in the basis, independent of our conceptual framework, it would mean if a caveman walked in the door, they'd see pen and start writing with it. But probably a caveman would walk in and see maybe some sort of weapon to stab with. And then, of course, if a dog came in, they'd maybe see some sort of chewing stick. And if a tiny ant came here, maybe they'd see some sort of home to live in. So is this a pen, a weapon, a chewing stick, or a home? From its own side, none of those things. From the side of the observer, all of those things. So we bring the pen into existence in our conceptual framework. So therefore, the pen is not the collection of the parts. The pen is merely labelled depending on the collection of the parts. And this is where we get into trouble. Because in the way we speak. Because we have a basis. And this basis here is changing moment by moment, constantly. And then we have a label, pen, which we're applying to the basis. But the label and the basis are not the same thing. We have a basis and we have a label. And the label is applied to the basis, but it's not the basis. Because if it was the basis, then what would be nonsensical to talk about applying something to the basis if it is the basis? It would be the basis applied to the basis, and it doesn't make sense. So we have a label we're applying to the basis because it's useful and meaningful and helpful. And if we understand that, we understand reality. But unfortunately, in our behavior, we're not behaving as if we are applying the label pen to this basis. In our behavior, we say, this is a pen. As if the pen is there from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework. And that's the problem. That's where the problems begin. And we're going to look in the next section, in the next session, at why that is a problem. Why is it a problem to say this is a pen? Why is it a problem to believe that the pen exists from its own side there in the basis? That's what we're going to look at in the next session. But just a couple more things now, and then maybe there's some questions, is again, a measure or one measure of beginning to understand something about emptiness is to understand that these two statements are not saying the same thing. The statements are, this is a pen, or the pen is the collection of the parts, versus the pen is merely labeled depending on the collection of the parts. If we can understand those two things are not saying the same thing, we're beginning to understand something about emptiness. One more thing and then maybe some questions. We say that the pen depends on its parts. Or in other words, the whole depends on the parts. But this view is also saying the part depends on the whole. So how does the part depend on the whole? How does the part depend on the whole? We can only call this part of a pen if we have the idea pen. Otherwise, what part what? Part of what? So you can only have part if there's a whole. Whether or not the whole exists is irrelevant. But you can only call this part of a pen if you have the idea pen. So part depends on whole, just like cause depends on result. Okay. And this is a key point, which is going to be very helpful in the next session and tomorrow morning as well. Any questions on dependent arising?
Yeah. How's that explaining the idea that when no one in the room, the computer is not existent?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, well, I was going to come later, but I'll give you a brief answer now. Is this big? So you can't have big on its own, correct? You can't have big and small. Mm-hmm. You can only have big and small relative, correct? Mm-hmm. Like that, you can only have up with down, in with out. Like that, you can only have me relative to not me, correct? Correct? You accept that? You can only have me relative to not me. Mm-hmm. That not me could be you, the world. So you can only have experiencer relative to experienced. Correct? Experienced? We walk out the door?
So you say no one here to say this is computer and this is
everything. But again, usually when people ask this question, they're asking with the assumption there's an independent me here who's walking out the door. Correct? Isn't that what we're grasping onto when we're asking this question? Me, there's a me here, and I definitely exist independently. I'm walking out the door. Is the laptop still on the table? If that is true, if there is an independent me walking out the door, then of course, yes, there's a laptop still existing here on the table. This is Vaibhashika Sautrantika view. There is an independent objective world. Exactly. That is Vaibhashika Sautrantika view. So the real question is, when you ask, when I walk out the door, ask the question, who's the me that's walking out the door? Then you'll get an answer. It'd be like saying, now we're saying, big, blah, blah, walking out the door. I mean, it just makes no sense. You know, we're saying, oh, but if big walks out the door, there's still small, isn't there? I mean, does that make sense? If we take big out, if big walks out the door, there's still small there, surely. Isn't it? It's the same argument. Any other questions?
When you say that when you have two things changing from one thing to another, and then if that's the case, then one of them ceases to exist, then where did that come from?
Do you mean this idea here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about when you mix, for example, water with salt? Okay, so then it changes. But where did it come from? Water ceased to exist, but it's still there. You know what I mean?
No. So I think what the confusion is, we need to distinguish between these two things. Cause here is substantial cause, meaning that's the thing that transforms into the result. So the substantial cause of the plant is the seed. The seed transforms into the plant. The conditions are all the other things that affect that process. So if you have water and you add salt, then that water is still water, but now it has salt. That's okay. Is that the point?
Yeah.
So.
But it's not water anymore.
It is water.
It's salty water.
Yeah, it's water with salt in it.
Okay, if you put something.
I mean, this is still atomically based stuff with other things in it. I mean, we're talking about the transformation. So what we need to be careful about is distinguishing between these two things. Yeah. Any other questions?
What you said, like, you can exist only because there is no you. Like, me and not me.
Mm-hmm.
I can exist only if there is no me.
If there's something that's not you, yes.
Uh-huh.
I mean, otherwise you would say this is big. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense, does it?
Mm-hmm.
No? And we're going to be looking at the person in more detail tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to do in the next session is explain why is it a problem to see things as already divided up into many separate things, discrete things? Why is it a problem to believe that the world is not a mere appearance, that the world is not merely labeled, that there is an objective world there? What's the problem with seeing it like that? That's what we're going to look at for in the next session. And in fact, the assertion here is that this is the root of suffering. This grasping onto me, independent world, that is the root fundamental ignorance that is causing us to be stuck in samsara. And how that is and how that operates, we're going to look at in the next session. Okay. There was one thing I wanted to add, but not here. Okay, maybe if there's any one more question, and then otherwise we'll just go for a break.
Actually, actually the laptop question. Mm-hmm. I understand when we all, I don't really know, when we all go out, then is it there or not?
It. So, laptop. So if Big goes out, is Small there?
Small not, but there is something there.
Oh, there is?
Yeah.
Independent of the observer. You can have object without subject.
And if we all go out and the monkeys come in, the laptop will be here.
So again, with all of these questions, generally people are asking this on the basis of grasping onto independent me. And if that's our assumption, then of course when we walk out the door, the laptop is still here. Of course. Has to be. Unless you're a Chittamatra view where you say it's just internal to the mind. But generally, if you believe there's an independent subject, of course there must be independent object. Of course. Or no objects exist at all. But that's nihilism.
The more I hear this, relates to me to quantum physics. The consciousness of the observer that gives sense to the reality. There's something in the back of my head thinking, are we still talking about just theoretical concepts, or are we approaching to physical, tangible things? The moment you are out in this reality, is the computer is going to be still here? I mean...
It.
Samsung.
It.
It.
So there's one thing here.
Yeah, then we're back. Then we're back.
Didn't we create the laptop?
Of course not.
Didn't we create the laptop by drawing a line around a particular collection of data?
The labeling, yes.
So there's more. Is there one thing here, or how many things are here?
Several.
So, but you said it. When we go out, it's still there. So aren't you then grasping onto there being one thing here when you say it is still there?
Yeah.
So. When we go out the door, there's a pen here? Or is there a weapon here? Or is there a chewing stick here? Or is there a complete home here?
Because it will all depend on the label that the person that is going out.
Right. But isn't atom a label that we use to describe, to help us understand things?
So
even atoms are concepts.
Yes. So
even Higgs boson is a concept.
So we're talking about theoretical concepts, labels. In other words, we're not...
To describe reality.
To describe reality.
So this view is not saying there are no atoms, there are no physical things. This view is not saying everything is just a fabrication of our mind and there is no physical world. Not saying this. Chittamatra says this.
Uh-huh.
They say there's no physical world. It's all mental. It appears to be physical, but it's not. This view is not saying there is no physical world. But if we investigate this physical world, does it exist independent of the conceptual mind? That's the question.
Two different things.
Yeah. So this view is saying there is an external physical world, but a dependent world. Not independent. And the whole difficulty here, and this is what we're going to come up with, particularly tomorrow morning, is we are stuck in what's called the two extremes. For us, there's only two options now. Either there is this external, independent, real, functioning world, or there's no world. So if we negate that, for us, that's the same as negating existence itself. Because for us, there only seems to be these two options. Because the only world that we've related to is this apparent, independent, external world. And so if we negate that, for us, that's the same as, well, there's no world at all. I don't exist. The world, nothing exists. So we flip between these two extremes. This view, Majjhimika, is middle way. There's a third option between those two extremes. And that's what we're trying to find, that middle way between those two extremes. And it's something that's not easy to find. Not easy at all. Because we're so holding on to this real independent world so tightly, and that if we actually manage to understand that that doesn't exist, we just, usually the most common thing is we just flip to the other stream. Okay, there's no, nothing really exists. And so we just sort of flip backwards and forwards between those two extremes. And it's very hard to find that middle way. But we're going to look at how to find that middle way in the next, particularly tomorrow morning, we're going to look at that in more detail. Okay, let's take a break.